This is the UVic Military Oral History Program interview with Major Murray Edwards, recorded on March 12th at Victoria, BC, by Kimberly Dunn. Major Murray Edwards, do I have your permission to record the interview?
Mm-hmm.
So can you state your name, given your given name and your surname?
Mm-hmm.
So you just need to state your given name?
Right.
And your surname?
The which?
Your given name and your surname.
Yes.
So mm-hmm. Murray Edwards?
Yep.
All right, so we can begin now. So you want to do some introduction first?
Right, any more than what I've given you here?
Well, it's just to go on the interview tape so people mm-hmm. know.
Well, you want to restrict this to Cyprus?
Yes.
Right, well, go back to the beginning. When Cyprus was given their independence by Britain, they wanted to make a government that's left behind that would be fair to both sides. If you go back originally, Cyprus was all Turkish. The Turks are primarily farmers, peasants, you might say. The Greeks are businessmen. Cyprus is very rich in almost everything you could think of, from fruits to minerals. Greece is a very poor country. So Cyprus was something that was close, that could be exploited by the Greeks. What they did initially was to, excuse me, was to buy up a property from the Turks to the point where they finally got to where they were the majority. And they were the majority when Britain gave them their independence. Now, what Britain did to try to keep a balance, take the Department of Agriculture. The head of the department would be a Greek. His deputy would be a Turk. Go to Interior Affairs, the head would be a Turk and his deputy would be a Greek. And that worked fine until General Grievous of Greece and Archbishop Makarios, who was the president of Cyprus, decided they wanted the whole thing. And they had to have an incident that would give them the excuse. And this happened on Christmas Eve of 1963. A Turkish couple coming out of a movie were accosted by Greek police, started an argument, and then they shot them. That was the signal then to go into the local hospital, in which they murdered every Turkish patient, doctor, nurse. At the same time, a number of villages, almost biblical, they had marked the houses where Turks lived, because they were, it was in most villages, they lived together quite peacefully, and they murdered other people in their houses. And that was when the United Nations was first alerted, and the whole thing got out of hand. And the Greek government side of it turned to the British, who still had two big bases there, to restore order, which they did. But as soon as they had restored order, they then turned their back on the British and with no thanks and turned to the United Nations. And here, this is one of the biggest weaknesses of the United Nations. The United Nations can only go into any country by invitation. Here, it was the Greeks that were calling on them, and then the Turks. And the United Nations headquarters in New York decided, since the Greeks were the majority, they would deal with the Greeks. Well, automatically, that made every Turk a rebel. And that was the start of the whole fiasco. And it ultimately came to the point where Turkey intervened, but they made the matter even worse. They did the invasion, but they only went far enough to just stop the Greeks. But they didn't go far enough to occupy enough of the island for the Turkish side to have a viable country. The net result was that they withdrew and left the Turkish Cypriots with literally nothing. And to this day, those people have never been recognized as a government. They are stateless people. The states, Canada, ignore them completely. Just the same as the Palestinians. They are stateless people because no one will recognize them because they don't have a homeland as such. So that's your background.
All right. So when they told you you had to go to Cyprus, did you have much time to be ready for Cyprus?
No. First incident took place on Christmas Eve, and it was about 6 weeks later that the United Nations agreed to enter. And I literally got a notice overnight to report to Ottawa, and then we were flown to Cyprus. Canada was put in charge of the Nicosia area, and then Brigadier Tedley, he was general later, he was in charge of the Nicosia area, and he had under his command a battalion of Canadians, a battalion of the Danish, British on call, and a brigade of Finns. That was the central control for the United Nations. And we were stationed in what had been the clubhouse of one of the big golf courses. So that was quite comfortable. And I went out as what they call a watchkeeper. We took turns in manning the headquarters and what activities were going on. Give you a typical example. and we had the Van Dew there with the Canadian at that time. And one of their patrols went out and they found a decomposing body. Between them, the Turks and the Greeks in a so-called no man's land. And it was identified as Turkish. And they wanted to move it and bury it properly. The Greeks are very, very clever at using an opportunity. So they then said, no, we can't let the Turks in that area. They'll have to stay there. So at that point, the battalion commander sent a party down and covered the body with dirt. The Greeks then said, the body is now buried, and a buried body cannot be moved for 7 years. Well, that took some more negotiating. I was the one doing the negotiating. They finally agreed that they would let a Turkish ambulance go in and move the body, but no one wants to go with the ambulance. And there was, CBC had a crew out there, and they heard about it. They phoned our headquarters and asked permission to go with the ambulance. And I said, no, the agreement with the Turks is the ambulance goes in with the Turkish party, no one else. They ignored what I told them, and they went in anyway. And the minute they appeared on the scene, the Greeks opened fire on them. And they ended up with a jeep in the ditch, and very lucky for them, the jeep was between them and the Greeks, so they, although the Greeks kept shooting, they didn't get hit. But again, that's a typical situation. Give you another one. A lot of the isolated Turkish villages were hard to be kept supplied. And The Greeks controlled all the ports. They could bring in heavy artillery and tanks and anything they wanted. The Turks had nothing like that. So Turkey shipped in some armaments for them by submarine, and they landed at a little village on the north side of the island. The minute the Greeks heard about this, they opened fire on the village with artillery. And General Tamayo, who commanded all the UN troops, went to visit them. Now, I better backtrack. I'm getting ahead of myself. I said that I was there as what they called a watchkeeper in the headquarters. We had a complaint. One of the first things we did in Nicosia, the capital, we divided the city, and that side was Greek, this side was Turks, and a so-called green line barrier between them. We got a complaint that young Greeks had gone into this area overnight, and I went down to investigate. Oh, by that time they'd go on. But two well-dressed Turkish businessmen came up to me and said, "Sir, do you think you could help us?" I said, "What's the problem?" They said, "We own a small steel wool shop, and we make our steel wool from a very high quality steel that comes from Germany. Our latest shipment has arrived, but it's in a Greek-controlled port, and the Greeks won't give it to us. Do you think you could do anything about it?" So I went back and told my brigadier, and he said, "Well, go down to the Greek government people and see if you can arrange something." And I went down and I got hold of one of the ministers, and he just laughed. He said, "If they think that they're going to get their steel, they've got another thought coming." So I went back and I said, "I'm very sorry," I said, "but I couldn't do anything for you." So they said, "Well, go back and tell them that we make the only steel wool on the island. And if they want any steel wool, they better let us have our steel." So I went back again. Well, this time I managed to negotiate that the Greeks would get half of their production, and I got the steel rods. Well, immediately, all kinds of other requests came in. "Could you do this? Could you do that?" And I found myself taking off my duties with the Canadian headquarters, and I was made the economics and welfare officer for the island. And the United Nations had taken over the old British Wolseley Barracks, and they had specialists there, specialists in housing, specialists in health, and so forth. And they gave me an office with them. And again, General Tedley had an Irishman with a real Irishman's sense of humor. And I told him that I had this office, and that the representatives were all there from New York, except for a Chinese gentleman who was a Mr. Wong, who would be arriving shortly. So General Tedley said, "I'd like to meet these people." So I said, come down and I'll do that. Well, he arrived. In the meantime, Mr. Wong had been replaced by a different Chinaman named Liu. And when I introduced General Tedley to Mr. Liu, he said, "Ah, you are in lieu of Wong." Typical Irishman. Anyway, the thing just grew. More and more activities came into being. And it was a wide range, everything from reopening factories and flour mills to recovering pension checks and something like that. Because a lot of the Turks had served in the British forces, but the Greeks controlled all the mail coming in. And then instead of passing it on, they were putting it in a warehouse. And it took me about 2 weeks to finally negotiate the release of all those pension checks, but that was part of the job. One village, the one that I told you was hit with artillery, the people were just living in caves. The houses all been destroyed, no food. And we arranged a a convoy of food for them. And they went through that. And a big shipment of food came in from Turkey. And I arranged to make another shipment. But the Turks were just as wily at playing both ends. And said, oh, there are other villages that are also starving. The food must go to them. Well, the Greeks, of course, heard that the Turks weren't going to give any food to this little village. So they make a great show. They gather all kinds of food and olive oil and rice and whatever. And it's piled up on the steps of the government palace. And Archbishop Macarius makes a great speech to the media. The Turks would starve their own people, but we will not see our brothers starved like that. And we are going to send food to them. So I had it loaded in two trucks, and almost reaching the village, we're suddenly stopped by armed young Turkish men. We will not take any gift from a Greek. So I said, well, it's yours. And I had it all unloaded and put on the side of the road, and I left. And I went back and I told the Greeks that they wouldn't accept it. Well, they just laughed, because if it had been them, they would have taken it. Anyway, I negotiated back and forth. Finally, I said to the Turks, if you won't take it, would you buy it? Yes, that was honorable. We'll buy it. And I said, fine, I'll go back and see how much the Greeks want for it. So it was something like 520 pounds, a separate pound. Went back and they said, how much? No way. And there's a bag of beans that are broken. He knew him. Anyway, we finally negotiated back and forth. And after a couple of days, they finally settled and paid for it and took it. But honor had been recognized. So, but that's typical of what it was like. In this one, at the back of it, there's a lot of the economic reports and so forth that you can see. Anyway, briefly, that's the situation.
Did you find, when you were negotiating between the Greeks and the Turkish Cypriots, did you have a language divide?
No. On both sides, they all spoke English, as well as Greek and Turkish. One of the things that struck me, I was dealing with people. And when I got to know some of the older Greeks, they would say, you know, we wish the British were still here, because everything was peaceful then. And that was on the Greek side. But of course, the younger ones, they wanted everything was black and white between them. So we had one case, the Greeks were bringing in heavy artillery, and we would try to locate where they took it. And we had a suspicion that a lot of it had been on a Greek farm. And the RAF took us in by helicopter to search it. And the helicopter blew a lot of the fruit off the trees. And the Greek farmer came out and fired at him with a shotgun. And then he realized what he'd done, and he wanted to make peace. And he showed up at our headquarters the next day with a whole bag of melons and peaches. And our medical officer was a Danish chap. And he got his hypodermic out and he pointed contro into all the melons. What else? Yeah, here's another good example. There was an outbreak of anthrax in a Turkish village that was surrounded by Greek control. And I arranged that a veterinarian from the Turkish side would go in to do the inoculation and so forth. To which the Greek said, no way. If we allow a Turkish veterinarian to go in there, he'll see all our positions. We'll send a Greek veterinarian in. Oh, no, no, said the Turks. If a Greek comes in, he'll see all our positions. So finally, screened our UN troops, and I finally found a Danish veterinarian who was doing reserve service. And I went back to the Greeks and I said, I have a Danish veterinarian, here's his qualifications, and he's ready to go in. What vaccination is he using? I said, he's got a very good Turkish vaccination. No, no, on this island you can only use our vaccination. French. I said, fine, just let me have that. Oh, no, no, it's $450. So I went back, well, there were no funds for like that you could call it, but International Red Cross had a representative from Geneva, whom I knew quite well. And I knew he had a petty cash fund for extended like this. So I went and I said, here's my problem. So he gave me the money to buy it. And when I gave it to the Danish veterinarian, I said, I paid $450 for that. I said, would that be sensible? No, he said, $250 would be closer to it. So the minister made $200 on it.
Did you find with your negotiations between Turkish and Greek, did you find a lot of hostility, or was it more, was it easier to negotiate with the
At that
two?
Time, it wasn't so much hostility as frustration, because the Greeks especially would play everything out as long as they could and finally give in. But in the early stages, now I'll give an example. Here's the island, here's Nicosia, here's the north coast, and high land here and here with a road going through. The Greeks every night would be on this side. Now, I'm not talking the army, I'm talking civilians. The Greeks would be here and the Turks would be there. And they would start off with insulting family members, because they all knew each other. They'd insult each other first. And then it would go up and up until they were finally insulting Archbishop Macarius and Dr. Crudo on the other side. And then they would start shooting. Never hit anything. But after a couple of weeks, one of the Turks was hit. More apologies. They didn't mean to do that. But after I left, it got quite vicious. And there was a lot of guerrilla fighting and so forth before the Turkish army came in. So that was the general situation.
Did you have a specific way of dealing with the hostility or the tension or the frustration?
Well, the only thing the United Nations tries to normally do if hostility is to interpose themselves between the two sides. You can't shoot each other without shooting us. And oftentimes we did get shot at. The United Nations has lost several, Canadians alone have lost over 100 in peacekeeping incidents. So most of our losses have been in Africa, but there was quite a number in Cyprus later.
And with that, so did you patrol the Green Line yourself, or did you just know of it?
What do you mean?
The Green Line that they may put in between of the Greeks and the Turks, did you patrol it, or did you just stick to your duty?
My duties were strictly economic and welfare. I had to, my duties were more negotiation than anything else. Mm-hmm. And I worked by myself. I didn't have an escort or arms or anything like that. So it was a case of, over my time, building up contacts. That was the key to my work. The peacekeeping and so forth, that was a little different. Again, I mentioned that General Tedley had a sense of humor. As a show of bravado, the Young Turks used to put on a demonstration every couple of weeks against the Greeks and so forth. And when this would happen, it was a bit of a farce, really. General Tedley would call out our recce unit. We had an armored recce unit. And at the head of this recce unit, he would march up to the demonstration. And at that point, the Young Turks would disperse because, again, honor had been served. We have been recognized. But on this occasion, when he arrived, they weren't Young Turks. There were about 50 middle-aged Turkish women banging pots and pans and looking very aggressive. Well, what did General Tedley do? He pulled a handkerchief out and surrendered.
And in 5 minutes, everybody was laughing. But that's how things can be diffused if you got the right man.
Did you find you were prepared for your job as an economic and social officer?
Prepared, how do I put it? Yes and no. It was a job you learned as you went along. But I'd been a quartermaster, for instance, in the battalion. So that side of it, with supplies and so forth, I was familiar with. The biggest thing was learning how to negotiate and to keep both sides talking to each other. They wouldn't talk direct. And one of the ministers that I dealt with on the Greek side was Mr. Christiopoulos. And I got to know him quite well. His opposite number was a Mr. Ramadan on the Turkish chamber. And one day he said to me, "Major Edwards, when you see Mr. Ramadan, would you say hello for me? We went to school together, and now we can't talk to each other." And that's the tragedy of these things.
So with your relations, which would you say one side was better with your relations? Like, were the Greeks more, or?
The Greeks were, because the Greeks had been recognized by the United Nations, they were in the driver's seat. Whatever they did, as far as New York was concerned, they were in the right. On the ground, with us, personally, of course, it was a different situation entirely. It was more a case of, because they were in control, to get them to give in on issues. And that something that could be settled in 10 minutes of conversation might take almost a week. You meet with this side, go back to that side, and then back and forth again. Because, as I say, they just would not talk to each other.
Did you find with the Turkish Cypriots that they needed more aid? Did you find that you had to get more food to them? Because they had such a small area?
We had both our own source of food and food from the British bases, because they were very good about helping us. And Turkey shipped in food. So on that side, it wasn't too bad. Give you an idea of how how short-sighted the Greek side could be. A truckload of crated oranges would come in and arrive at Nicosia. And these Young Turks would deliberately destroy it, never giving the thought to who owns it. And oftentimes the shipment would be from one of their own Greek farmers. But when you get these young ones taking over that way, there is no control. And in spite of complaints by their own people, it wasn't evident that the Greek authorities were trying to do anything about controlling those young ones. So that was half a problem.
Did you then? So there wasn't a divide between the younger generation and the older generation?
Oh yes, there was quite a divide.
And did you experience any kind of refugee problem in Turkey, like on the Turkish side
at
or the Greek
point,
side?
At that point, it hadn't reached the point of refugees. It was, you see, most of Greece, of Cyprus, Greeks and Cypriots lived together in harmony, had done for centuries. It was only when the Greeks fomented this revolution, or civil war, literally, that people in an area controlled by the Greeks, the Turkish Cypriots would have to just move out. But at that time, they were able to move into Turkish villages, and Greeks left controls in the Turkish area for Greek areas. So, in the early stages, that took care of the refugee side of it.
Did you have some free time? Did you do any extra activities?
We all got 2 weeks leave while we were there. And hard to believe, but on the western end of Cyprus, the Troodos Mountains, actually get enough snow to have skiing in the wintertime. You don't think of that, but it's a very pleasant area, as I say, mountains and villages and hotels, and in peacetime catered for a lot of tourists. So normally that's where we went when we had our leave. So.
Did you go skiing? Did you go skiing? Did you try any of that?
Oh, I was there. No, there was no snow when I was there.
Oh, okay.
Wrong time of the year.
So with the variety of your duties, you mostly just dealt with the negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any other duties to do besides the economic part of
things? That was a full-time job.
That was full-time?
Yeah.
All right. Do you have any other kind of experiences that supplemented your experience at Cyprus? In your books, you say you had some Turkish friends.
Mm-hmm.
Did you guys have any spare time to do things together, or?
Oh well, I stayed in my quarters in the Canadian headquarters, and I worked out of our headquarters, so I was always with my own people. I say own people because we had quite a cosmopolitan group. We had, Canadians, Danes, British. So it was a rather cosmopolitan headquarters.
And your relations with your people, they were good? They all helped each other out?
Oh, yes. So, but as I say, my duties were divorced really from the duties of the rest of the Canadians. They were there more for the peacekeeping role as opposed to what I was doing.
And did you feel that your role was important and that you got a lot accomplished?
Oh yes. The work I did was recognized. As a matter of fact, when my time was up, New York asked Ottawa if I could be extended, and Ottawa said no, so I came home. Well, I'd only been home a couple of months, and I was stationed with the battalion here in Victoria, and a new commanding officer came in. I knew him, and they had a reception for him when he arrived, and at the reception, he said, I suppose you wondered why you were never allowed to stay on in Cyprus. And I said, how did you know about that? I'm the one that stopped it. I said, what? He said, I was on the international desk in Ottawa when the request came in, and he said, I didn't let it go any further. He said, there are too many Canadians like you. You go abroad for these duties, and you forget you're a Canadian and start to identify with the people you're working with. And I figured it was about time you were brought home. Now, that's the kind of thinking you sometimes get.
Would you have stayed longer in Cyprus if they had requested
it? They wanted me to stay 3 more months. And to show you how short-sighted they were, now, it took me a long time to make all my contacts and so forth. They would not allow the chap who's going to replace me come in ahead of time. He came in on the plane from Ottawa at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I left at 12 o'clock for Canada. I didn't even have time to show him my office, introduce him to anybody, nothing. And that is the kind of short-sightedness you get in a headquarters.
So your replacement was not trained for the duties?
I tried to keep in touch afterward, but after that, the whole thing started to break down. And the true fighting really took place. So there wasn't much that my replacement could have done anyway.
In one of your books, you mention a time where a major went missing. Was that a typical occasion where people disappeared?
Right, it's in here.
And so, can you explain?
What happened was a tobacco salesman from Britain, who normally made the rounds of the islands delivering selling cigarettes and tobacco and so forth, was ambushed by a couple of Turks, murdered, and they took his all his money and all the cigarettes and so forth. And this British major was given the job of investigating who did it. And he came for lunch with us, and he said, we've got to the point, I know who did it. And the next thing we knew, he'd been ambushed and murdered. And it's all in there. but he had done enough. He didn't leave his notes or anything, but enough information that was handed over to the Greek police that they identified the murderers and arrested them. But to show you how cold-blooded they could be, they ambushed he and his driver, and then they went over their bodies with a harrow until they chopped them up so there was nothing left to be identified. But there were enough people on the Greek side to talk that the police finally got who did it. But the whole thing is there.
Was there that kind of violence against UN peacekeepers?
Not in the beginning.
Not in the beginning.
But it got that way later. Mm-hmm. Especially on the Greek side. because they took the attitude, you're trying to stop us from establishing a proper Greek island. And
right. So when you were done at Cyprus, were your ending thoughts the same as your initial? Did you have any change in thought of the situation?
Well, my thought was, how could anyone take a situation where everybody was happy, everybody was prosperous, and deliberately destroy it on the basis of nationality? Because that's what it came down to. Greeks against Turks. But on the Turkish side, until they were pushed, there wasn't that animosity.
You know. All right. Did you feel like when you had arrived at Cyprus, the situation was explained to you clearly?
Well, when we arrived, we had literally been picked up and just dumped down. It wasn't until our Brigadier Tedley had a lot of meetings and so forth with the UN command that we got properly briefed on just what was going on. The general commanding the whole was a General Tamaya from India. He had served many years in the British Army, and now he was a senior general with the Indian Army. And he had been appointed by the United Nations, and a real gentleman and a real commander. As far as the command was concerned, there's only so much you can do. As I said, the UN is there as a guest, and in this case, a guest of the Greeks. So it could be very frustrating.
Were you given peacekeeping training before you went, or were you literally picked up and dropped off?
I was literally picked up and gone.
Dropped off.
Yeah.
How would you evaluate the mission that you were on?
As far as my side of it was concerned, yes, it was very successful. Mainly because at that time I was able to get people to work together. The Greeks had to feel they had won something. So you gave them something in exchange for something. A lot of saving face.
Did you think that the Canadian participation was worthwhile in Cyprus?
Oh yes, very much so. As far as we were concerned, while I was there, we how can I put it? We kept the lid on the kettle. Later on, it just blew apart, but that was well after my time. Because we were in Cyprus for many, many years after that. This was the very first contingent.
And as the first contingent, you found that, you know, the violence had kind of dissipated and that it was a little bit easier to negotiate between the two sides?
Yeah, you could still get, they wouldn't talk to each other, they would talk through me. A lot was accomplished that way.
All right, so do you have anything else you would like to add? I know we didn't go over your family background as you have it written down on these pages.
Yeah. Well, let's take a look and see if there's anything else here. Now, I don't know if this would be of interest to you, but these are Canadian ranks. That's comparing American and British Canadian.
All right.
And I don't know, would you like a picture of the medals?
Yeah, that would be good.
Take a picture. Okay, I'll get a picture of them for you.
So overall, your experience in Cyprus was a good one, you would say.
Yes.
And it was
very, very. I don't think I ever worked much harder in the Army, but it was a satisfying job because you could see you were accomplishing something.
And it was different than your other duties you had had in the Army?
I've never had anything like it before. It was one of those things that the situation created the job. Mm-hmm. Well, as far as I'm concerned, as far as the United Nations are concerned, Cyprus was a failure.
Mm-hmm. And even though it had been successful on your part, why would it be a failure?
Because, again, the conditions. If the United Nations can't go into a country except by invitation, who invites you? And here's a country now divided in civil war. And the United Nations decided to recognize the Greeks because there were more Greeks than there were Turks. And as I said, that made every Turk a rebel. They weren't represented by the... And that was the flaw that led to failure.
If it had been the Turkish people that had called in the UN, do you think it would have been a bit different?
If New York had said, we will only come in at the invitation of both sides, it would have made a big, big difference.
A lot of talk has said that, you know, the UN participation prolonged Cyprus, the conflict, because it's still going on today. Would you, how are your thoughts
on
that?
No, I don't think it prolonged it. I think the events as they finally developed, it took time for that to happen. And as I say, what Turkey did in the end made the whole thing worse. They exacerbated the whole situation. But if this is Cyprus and here's Turkey, they only invaded about that. Instead of coming in far enough to establish a homeland for the Turkish Cypriots, and then they didn't stay there to make sure that the Greeks observed what had happened. Instead of that, they withdrew, which left the Greeks complete control. So, and then to turn around and the whole world to say, we only recognize the Greeks, we don't recognize the Turkish Cypriots, and they ended up as a stateless people. They don't have a passport, they don't have, they have nothing. So, that is the real tragedy of Cyprus.
So, all right. So this concludes the military oral history interview with Major Murray Edwards on March 12th. I have this oral history interview release form if you want to look it over and sign it. And this one right here, sign right there. And then I can fill out the rest for you. So,
and when you've gone through that, if you have any more questions, you know, give me a ring.
All right. So thank you for participating. And we both signed the interview release form. So that concludes our interview.
Right.